Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor exists to help people find their way back to God. This week we wrap up our stories from the flannel graph as Pastor Tim helps us take another look at the story of Naaman. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
You all look good. Welcome to South Harbor. If I haven't met you yet, my name's Tim. I'm glad you're with us. Abby named it. We were in the news on CNN and BBC for two different things. Yeah, if you don't know what, I'm not going to tell you. Just don't eat Taco Bell for just a minute, yeah. if you have a Bible, we're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5. We are in a series that we are calling Back to the Flannel Graph. And anyone here who's in like Christian education or uses flannel graph, I have a whole new respect for you. It is actually the hardest part of this series is remembering to do the flannel graph. So if this is what you do, please. The series is almost over now, so like it's a little late, but. One of the things we've discovered as we've been working through this, I hope, is that the stories themselves are well-known. We picked intentionally well-known stories. If you grew up in church, even if you didn't, many of them are well-known, but it is the details of the story that we tend to often skip where the story itself comes most alive. And that's especially true for the story we're going to look at this morning. Of all of the stories we've looked at, this is probably the least well-known, and yet it's the details of this particular story. We're going to look at a story of the time when a guy by the name of Naaman, who has leprosy, goes and visits a prophet named Elisha. And I love this story. So I hope you do too. But it's the details in this one. In particular, there is an exchange that happens at the end of the story between the two main characters. And this particular exchange, it is a story that happened back, you know, a couple thousand years ago. But this particular exchange in many ways reflects what I think a lot of us feel. If you ever found yourself in a spot where it feels like you're stuck in a decision and you're not quite sure what to do. Both, you have like two or three or four different options in front of you, and they maybe all feel like the right option, or they all feel like the wrong option, or the lesser of the wrong options, and you're not quite sure which option do I choose. Maybe you have two decisions before you, and neither particular decision feels good to you. Like, I have a friend who says, it just says, I don't have peace. My soul hasn't found peace with this decision. Maybe you're in a spot where it's like, I got to make a decision, but I don't have peace to this decision. There's a conversation and an interaction that happens at the end of the story that I find to be incredibly helpful. Before we do that, I want to introduce the characters, kind of walk through the story, because there's a lot at stake when they get to this exchange. And so we got to see kind of what's at stake. And so we're going to walk through it a little bit slowly this morning, because I want you to see what's at stake, but I love this story, and so I just want to kind of enjoy it with you as we walk through the story. It's 2 Kings chapter 5. We'll begin in verse 1, and I will do my best to use the flannel graph as we tell the story, but if I fall behind, I'm just warning you. This is the hardest part for me. But chapter 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1, now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier. Okay, so we're introduced to this guy by the name of, let's get the flannel graph up. We're introduced to this guy by the name of Naaman, and we're given some details about Naaman. Naaman's going to be the main character of our story, him and Elisha. But we're given some details. We're told that he is the commander, so he's in charge of the army of a country known as Aram. Let me show you Aram on a map. It's up here. Our story is going to take place in the city of Samaria. So he's going to travel down to Samaria. Eventually, that's where Elisha is going to be. But he's to the north. Aram at this time is an emerging mini empire, like a regional power, but it's emerging. And this guy's on top. not the king, but he is the king's right-hand man. And we're given a list of the things that this guy has accomplished, and it's an impressive list. The first thing we're told is he's a great man. In Hebrew, it's ish gadol. He's an ish gadol. And then we're told that he is highly regarded, and that he's had a lot of victory. He's had a lot of success, and that he is a valiant soldier. The word valiant in the Hebrew that this is written in is the word gabor. Gabor literally means strong or mighty. Like he's like a man's, look at that dude. He's like a man's man. He's he's gabor. He's ish gadol. To quote the prophet Ron Burgundy, he's kind of a big deal, right? So he's got this, and our author needs you to know, like, okay, we're going to start out and we're going to introduce this guy, and he's done some stuff. And then there is a comma. He was a valiant soldier, comma, but he had leprosy. Leprosy is a contagious skin disease. And there's a lot riding in that comma, right? Like there's a lot in that particular comma. We're given this list of success, but then you get to the comma and you realize, oh, this guy's, maybe he's had some success, but he's now finding himself in a spot where he can't fix himself. He's desperate. There's a lot in the comma. Some of us, like we've experienced that ourselves, right? Like she's an amazing mom, comma, but she struggles with self-esteem. He's a kind and caring boss, comma, but at home, life is not easy right now. He's a really, really smart and kind kid, or she's a really smart and kind kid, but he or she worries that no one else in the world sees them, and they feel like they're all alone in this world. There's a comma there, and there's a lot riding on the comma. She feels beautiful inside and out, but comma, she's exceptionally lonely at this point in her life. So we're told that we got an ish gadol with gabor. He's a man's man, and yet he's had a lot of success. He's a right-hand man of the king of an emerging empire, comma, but he's desperate. He's got a skin disease, and he is absolutely desperate. Now, what we're going to read next is we're going to be told a little bit about Aram and this military that he commands, and we're going to find out that he's actually the enemies of Israel. So like he's going to end up needing to go to Israel, but they're at Aram and Israel at this point are actually enemies. Notice what the author tells us, verse 2. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Pause again there. So we're told that Aram is the enemy of Israel. And not only are they the enemies, they steal things from Israel. And not just things, they steal people. Yeah, you've heard this phrase, human trafficking. That's Naaman's job. Naaman's job. If we're fuzzy on this, Naaman is the bad guy, right? He's the bad guy. He's the enemy of the Israelites. And they've had some success, but that success has meant he's taken some people. Now, what our author does in this little section is you're going to see this come throughout the story, but it's quite brilliant. In this particular story, it's the strong, valiant, gabor, ish gadol, military leader who is going to actually be quite weak and need a lot of help. And you've got a servant girl who actually, so she's quite weak in the culture. She's not even in her homeland. She's been taken. A servant girl who's actually going to be quite strong. And you're going to see this kind of come throughout the story. There's a subtle, in our Bible, it's all over the place if you're looking for it. It's a subtle critique of power. Power, human power is fragile. Human power is temporary. It's here one day and it's gone the next. The comma comes really, really quickly. And so to everyone on the outside, this girl, the servant girl, looks really weak, and yet she's the hero at this point in the story. And she says to Naaman, the commander of the army, the ish gadol, the gabor, the man's man, she says to him, "Hey, there's a prophet in Israel, the land you took me from, back in Samaria. If you were to go to see him, he may be able to heal you." Verse 4. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Aram replied. So notice his master is the king himself. He's a right-hand man of the king. By all means, go, the king of Aram replied. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter he took that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy. Now pause there. What's wrong with that request? Did the girl say the king is going to cure him? Help me out. No. Who did the girl say that could cure him? The prophet. Yeah. It's like they listen to her, but they don't really hear her. It's like they've got this preconceived notion of who should be the one that can do this work. And even though this girl said something else, they just actually don't really hear her. And so they take her advice, kind of. It's like they've got these categories of power in their minds. Who are the people that actually can get things done? Well, that's the king. That's not a prophet. That's the king. And so they're going to send him to the king, and the king of Israel is going to receive this message, like, I need healing, and he's going to panic. Verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes, tore his robes, and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone? I love this fellow. Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me. He's like, well, you just beat us in war. Now you're sending this guy. Is this a trap? Okay, recap on the story so far, so we're all kind of following along with the ordeal of the whole thing. Naaman is the right-hand man of the king, but he's got leprosy. And so he comes with a letter in hand from one king to another king. The king of Aram has a letter to the king of Israel. And not only does he have that, he has some stuff. We're told he has 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. And if you're like me and you're just like, I just need to know what I don't count in talents or shekels. So how much is that? I did the work for you. 10 talents of silver is 750 pounds of silver. It's not like a little bit of silver. This is a lot of silver. 6,000 shekels of gold is about 150 pounds. And then 10 sets of clothes is 10 sets of clothes. So he's got a lot of stuff, and he's the right-hand man of the king of a neighboring army, the enemies. He has taken people. He's won, and yet he's the commander of the army, a valiant soldier. He's Ish Gadol. He's Gabor. He, like, a man's man. He, like, drives a Silverado and smells like sawdust or something. Like, this guy, like, he's somebody. He's a man's man. And he comes to the king of Israel, and he's like, heal me. And the king of Israel hears this, tears his clothes, and says, who am I? Am I God? I can't do this. Once again, the critique of power. You've got the king of Israel in this moment looking quite helpless and quite pathetic and quite scared. And so, verse 8, notice what happens next. When Elisha, the man of God, When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. Let's just be honest. That's like the coolest line ever, right? Like, have him. Oh, king, you can't do it. Have him come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. Seriously, I suggest you try that line on this week. Just try it on. Like, you know, send him to me. He's got trouble with his receipts. Send him to me, and he will know that there's an accountant in Byron Center. Try it out. Car troubles. Send them to me, and they will know that there is a mechanic in, where's Mike? There's a mechanic that can solve this problem. There's the kids are struggling to eat their vegetables. Send them to me, and they will find out that there is a mom who knows how to work her Vitamix. She can solve the problem. I like Elisha a lot. So the first, this is like Elisha on the scene. Elisha's got like chutzpah. He's like, send to the king, send him to me. I I'll show you. Okay, so now this next part, you've got to use your imagination a little bit. You got to kind of got to try to picture it. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots. I'll try with the flannel graph. His horses and chariots. Yeah, we'll put him in the front. Went with his horses and his chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Again, pause. Elisha's a prophet. He's not rich. He's not powerful. He's not famous. When we read that he goes to his house, we are not, prophets live simple lives, wore simple clothes. Elijah, his like the guy that raised him up, his mentor, Elijah, we're told, like wore like the most simple clothes and lived the most simple life. So Elisha's gonna do similar, simple food. We're talking like a one bedroom, maybe a two bedroom house. This is what scholars think it might have kind of looked like, maybe a two bedroom house. And Naaman comes with horses and chariots. The translation to our world is this is like military stuff, right? Like this would be like going to somebody in a hut with fighter jets and tanks. Right, so you got the commander of the army showing up with fighter jets and tanks or horses and chariots. And notice how Elisha greets him. Verse 10, Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, I tell you, I like Elisha. He's like, oh yeah, you're powerful. Okay, you go deal with him. I'm busy. He sends a messenger and the message, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan and your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed. So Elisha says, go wash. Let me show you a picture of what the Bible refers to as the mighty Jordan River. There it is. It says, go wash in that and you'll be cleansed. A couple of details about the Jordan River. If you're in the north, so when we take groups there, we baptize in the north because north of the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River is quite clean and relatively wide. But the further south you go and kind of where this story would have taken place outside of Samaria, the dirtier and the smaller the Jordan River is. And so this is not a large, impressive river. This is a small, relatively dirty river, and it eventually will dump into the Dead Sea. And so this river, kind of where this story likely takes place, where he tells him to go bathe, we are talking about something small and something dirty. He's like, okay, king of the army, I need you to go dip in that. Okay, so verse 11. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Okay, you see the critique of power here, right? This is somebody who's got status and power, and he comes to the prophet, and he's got this whole set of expectations of how it's supposed to go. The prophet sent a messenger. No, he's supposed to come out to me, and he's supposed to do this like ritual thing, and then that would heal me. What is he doing? This is beneath me. Again, this guy is Gabor. He's Ish Gadol. Like, he's a man's man. This is beneath me. And then he says, are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Which I think we can all agree they are. Let me show you on the map. Okay. This is the Pharpar River and the Abana River. Today, the Abana River is known as the Barada River. It runs right through Damascus. It looks something like this. So they kind of channel it now, kind of like we do to contain it. But if you travel outside of the city, it looks something like this. The Jordan River looks something like that. Yeah. What would you rather dip into? This is like the water they spray on lettuce. Yeah, it's gross, right? I gotta use my filter. He says, couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? He's like, I got these rivers back home. They're better rivers. Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and he went off in a rage. Again, the weak are actually quite strong in the story, and the strong look quite pathetic. Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? So again, who gets it? Who doesn't get it? In the story, it's Naaman's servants. The first was a girl. We'll put her there. And we'll put a boy there for good measure. It's Naaman's servants in this particular story. who actually look like they're giving good advice. They actually can see, like, okay, they see beyond just the humbling nature of it and see, actually, this might be helpful. And it is the man's man who looks quite pathetic and storms off in a, my kids call it a crash out. He's crashing out. That's the theme. Like, it's again and again, it's throughout our Bible. Like, God will humble the exalted, and he will exalt those who have been humbled again and again. And so Naaman's servants come to him, and they say, hey, listen, Naaman, you mighty warrior, you great man, you gabor. Like, okay, listen, Naaman, here's the deal. I know that you think this is beneath you. I know that you say, well, I can just do that back home. But that hasn't worked. And let's just be honest. If he would have told you to do something big, would you not have done it? You would have. You look at all the stuff you showed up with. You've got like 6,000 like shekels. And like you've got 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothes. You got all this stuff. You came prepared. We know you. You're a guy who likes the big thing. If he would have told you to climb a mountain, you would have done it. If he would have told you to offer a giant sacrifice, you would have done it. If he told you to go run a marathon, you're desperate. You would have done it. But he says to go bathe in the river, and you think you're too good for that, and you're going to storm off in a rage? What if it actually works? Naaman in this moment thinks he's too good for the small things. He's too good for the small things. Stop there just for a second. Here's what I've discovered. At least for me, it feels like most of my character development in this season of life is by learning how to do the small things with great faithfulness, right? The big things that we want, I think it's through the small things that maybe God will offer opportunity for the big things, but the small things are what matters. Have you discovered that the people you look up to the most, like the people that... I don't know, they just live a life that you would someday want to live. Have you ever noticed that when you ask them about their life, the things they respond back to you are often the small things, right? They give you the little things. Have you noticed this? A good friend and mentor of mine in my previous church, and we were kind of going around doing a confession moment, and as a staff, kind of what are we trying to like offer to God? And for him, it was, I am just trying to go to bed on time, because I've learned if I don't go to bed on time, then I'm not able to get up on time to do my devotional life. And then he's like, this just sets my whole day up. And I look at this guy and he's like, oh yeah, we're focused on like, how do we, and he's just, okay, it's the small things. Several years ago now, a video went viral. It was a Navy SEAL. You probably remember this video. A Navy SEAL was sharing his advice. And the number one piece of advice he gives as he shares his advice is that if you cannot do the little things right, then you cannot be trusted with the big things. And so if you remember the video that went viral, he says, if you want to change the world, start by making your bed. Yeah, yeah. That resonated. We saw it because something in it felt true. It is true, right? It's the little things that add up to the big things, because how you do anything is how you do everything. You want to lose weight? Start by going for a walk. Start with breakfast. You want to show her you love her. Maybe not just a giant grand romantic gesture. Maybe that's helpful, but maybe start just by listening. You want to kick a habit. In the recovery movement, they'll always say, like, it's one day at a time, one moment at a time. It's the little things done consistently that add up to the big things. Ever notice that the people that are constantly complaining that things just aren't working out for them? If you actually, like, ask questions around it, they tend to have, like, these big hopes and these big dreams, and they're, like, dreamers by nature, and they got these giant hopes, but none of it's actually working out. If you notice that for many of them, they think they're too good or that they don't have to do the little things. And so the dreams just kind of remain dreams because they're too, I don't know, it's a little bit beneath me. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to eat healthier and begin exercise. Just give me the pill. Good enough. Naaman, the servants say, listen, you ish gadol, you gabor, you man's man. I know you think it's beneath you, but you're desperate, aren't you? You would have done the big things. and yet you don't want to risk looking silly? You're desperate. Go rinse in the Jordan and see. And then verse 14. So he went down, dipped himself in the Jordan seven times, as a man of God had told him. And his flesh was restored, and he became clean like that of a young boy. I like the details. Like his skin became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all of his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept a gift from your servant." Oh, by the way, we should... Horses go bye-bye. We'll put the servants bye-bye. We got the mighty Jordan River. No. Insert graphic number 47, leopard man. Its skin became fresh like that of a young boy. The prophet answered, verse 16, "As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." Even though Naaman urged him, he refused. Elisha says, "I don't want your stuff." Because sometimes you do the right thing because it's the right thing, not because you are trying to get more followers on Instagram. I don't need your stuff. I don't need your stuff. Then we get to the exchange. Like, we're setting up the exchange. This is the moment, right? This is, if you've tuned me out, lean back in. Naaman is healed, and he responds by saying this: "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel." Now, this particular declaration, would you agree? Massive leap forward for Naaman. Right? He was stealing people before this. He's from another country. They have other gods, and they are the enemies to Israel. And then he has this encounter. And the response to this particular encounter is to say, there is no other God in all of Israel, or in all of the world, except in Israel. Would you agree this is a huge leap forward for Naaman? Yeah. And he's also not done. He's half right. He's close. Let me explain. The dominant understanding in the ancient world were that gods were territorial. Every god had their territory, and any success you got in that territory was because of your particular god. And so, like, if this was our world, it would be like Canada has its god, and America has its god, and Mexico has its god, and each god has power in the turf that they are in their country. But once you cross the border, you're in another god's turf. This is how everyone understood the gods. So when he says there's no other god in all the world, massive leap forward. But when he says except in Israel, he's still locked into, okay, this God has power here, and there's no other God. My God clearly didn't have power. I see that now. However, he still thinks this God's power is localized, is territorial. So he's like half right. This is how growth works, right? You have a massive leap forward, and you see something you've never seen before, and your eyes are opened, and it is possible to think that now that you've seen the thing you've never seen before, you have all the answers to all the things, when actually it's like there's a door that's been opened, God has given you insight, but now we have to walk through the door and see what else God has for us. We are not done growing. We are not done learning. We have taken a massive step. Let's praise God for the massive step, but let's also be humble enough to recognize we do not know everything. I am not the same person I was 10 years ago. You are not the same person you were 10 years ago. So we continue to grow, and we see that in Naaman here. But it is a massive leap forward, but he's halfway there. Verse 17, he says, now we're at the exchange. He says, "If you will not," you will not receive my payment for all the stuff, said Naaman, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair," okay, "as a pair of mules can carry." So now he's healthy again. He's got his mules. Put them there. He says, "Give me as much dirt as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord." So, weird request. His request is, thank you, And here's some stuff, but if you won't take my stuff, will you give me some stuff? To quote the country song, I want to buy some dirt. Okay, so I need some dirt. Can you give me some dirt? I've got two mules. He also has some horses, but he was not going to leave those behind. I have two mules, and I would like to load those two mules with as much dirt as these two mules can carry. This in our world, would be like, I got 2 5-gallon buckets. Would you put some dirt in the buckets? I'm going to take those buckets home. That's a weird request. This is like the part of the story where we tend to leave it out of the kids' version of our Bible, because what do we do with this request? Until we recognize, again, that the gods in Naaman's mind are territorial. So every god has power in their region and not somewhere else. And what Naaman realizes is, I've got to go home. I've seen the power of this god. There's no other god. I've seen my god's failure. There is no other god except for this god. But I have to take some of your earth back to my place, back to my home in Aram, because the power is in the soil. So I need some dirt. I have my mules. I'd like to load them up with some dirt, please, sir, because I would like to go back home, and I would like to worship God. I don't know exactly what his intention is. Maybe he's going to like lay on a mound and that's where he'll worship and pray or offer sacrifices. But he says, can I load up my mules with some dirt so that I can bring it back with me? This is my one request. Again, it feels odd to us, but to him, it makes perfectly logical sense. This is God. He has power. I'm going home. I want that power to come with me. He's got one more request. One more favor to ask, verse 18. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Ramon, you know Ramon, the god of Aram. Everybody loves Ramon. When my master enters the temple of Ramon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, and I have to bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Ramon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. Do you catch the request? You see the dilemma? He's had this moment. Naaman has had a moment. He has experienced God. He's had a declaration that there is no other God except for the God in Israel. So he's not quite there. He still thinks God is territorial. Can I please have some dirt? Why? Because he needs to bring that back home. And then he says, because when I get back home, my master is the king. You don't mess with the king. And my king still worships Ramon. He hasn't had the experience that I've had. So I've got to go home, and I have to go back to work. And when I go back to work, well, I am not convinced that they're going to believe me, that we should just abandon everything that has led to our success up until this point in their minds. So would you please, when I'm like with the king, and the king goes down to offer sacrifices to Ramon, he leans on me, and I'm going to end up bowing too. And that's a problem, because I don't believe in Ramon anymore. So would you please, Elisha, put in a word with God and let him know, it's just my work. I don't actually buy it. I don't believe him. I've seen the light, and yet I have to do it. It's my job. What do I do? Now, what I'm expecting in this moment, okay? So without jumping ahead in the story, here's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting in this moment, Elisha the prophet, remember that chutzpah he has? Like, oh, I'll give you a servant. Remember the chutzpah? I'm expecting in this moment, Elisha gives it to him. How dare you? You come all the way here. You beg me for some help. I call upon God. God gives you healing. And now you're going to request an offer that keeps you still on your knees to Ramon? No. How dare you? How dare you? Like, I'm expecting that, right? I'm expecting him to be like, turn or burn, bro. Get right or get left, man, like some weird rapture thing. I'm expecting that's how he's going to respond. Notice how Elisha's going to respond. And this is the line for me that, verse 19, go in peace, Elisha said. That's how it ends. Go in peace. Now, we've talked a lot about the word peace is the word shalom. Shalom is not the absence of conflict. Shalom is the presence of God. So shalom is not just there's no, you know, like We're not fighting actively with each other, but shalom is everything as God designed it to be, everything in its right place. God is present with you in this moment, in this space. You have access to him. Elisha says to the request, Elisha to the request says, go, as in go home, in peace, as in God will be with you. Elisha never actually answers Naaman's question. Naaman's got a legitimate ethical dilemma. Do I bow or do I not bow? And Elisha never answers him. Now, why does Elisha not answer him? I imagine there is no answer, right? Like, I imagine if you were to answer this request, there's like 70 other questions that are going to come, because that's how life is, right? You answer one question, like, can I do the bowing thing? And if you were to say, no, you can't do the bowing thing. Okay, well, now you got 70 other questions. Well, should I quit my job? Because what other access to will the people of Aram have to God if I were to quit my job? So should I quit my job or should I not quit my job? How about, what if we go to war? I've had success. Do I just let any country just take over our people? Or do I fight? Do I actually stand up? Do I not stand up? Should I leave Aram and should I move to Israel where you already know God, but those people don't know God? Or should I stay and do my best to remain faithful to God? Do you see how if you answer one question, there's like another 50 questions, because life is actually quite complicated and we cannot pretend it's not quite complicated. You answer one question and 1,000 other questions still remain unanswered. Why I love this story is because it reminds us of what the Bible is doing all over the place. The Bible is far less concerned with telling us what to think. We like it to tell us what to think. Just tell us in black and white what to do. But it is far less concerned with telling us what to think and far more concerned with telling us how to think. Elisha realizes Naaman lives in the real world. And in the real world, there's often multiple options, and we're often torn between what is the best option. And in the real world, there are you can get a simple answer, but that simple answer just leads to multiple new questions. And you and I also live in this real world, even though we're not worried about carrying buckets of dirt. We live in this world. For instance, you have a friend, and she starts talking to you about her marriage. And you grew up believing that divorce is wrong. It's always wrong. You believe that. You sincerely believe that. You've seen people who have gone through divorce, and you've seen the heartache divorce causes. And yet, as she begins explaining the state of her house and how he treats her and what he does, you in good conscience can't tell her to go back into that marriage either. So what do you do? Welcome to the real world. Right? Like, it's just a little more complicated. Or how about this one? They ask you point blank if you know if so-and-so did such and such thing. Now, you believe that lying is wrong. You firmly believe that the truth will always win. Lying is wrong. And yet at the same time, you know that if you do know the answer, you do know what so-and-so did, and you know exactly what they did. But if you were to respond by telling that person what they did, you know that actually it's just going to cause more chaos in the world. So what do you do in that situation? Welcome to the real world. Or how about you've got a boss, and this boss has not been great, and this boss has not treated you great, and you've endured it, and then you see a coworker get treated the same way, and you know that that coworker doesn't deserve it. Do you stand up for the coworker? Now, you know that anytime you've tried to stand up, or anyone who has stood up to this particular boss gets fired. You need your job. You know that the boss likely doesn't change. You need this job. You like this job. And yet at the same time, what that boss is doing is not right. It's not okay. Somebody should do something about that. So what do you do? Yeah, you've got a coworker who tells you that her marriage is not great, and she's just going to take a little bit of time, and her husband are going to try to figure it out. And your boss confronts you and asks you where she is. Do you tell him or do you give her the space to work on her marriage? This is actually the world we live in. It's like 1,000 little ethically murky dilemmas. This is the world, and this is Naaman's world. It's complicated. And to respond to Naaman, Elisha says, go in peace. Go in peace is not dismissing the question. He's not answering it directly, but he's not dismissing it. Go in peace is not ignoring the reality of the weight that Naaman's feeling. Go in peace does not mean that this is no big deal or that you should just kind of do whatever you want to do. Go in peace is the simple recognition that this is tough. And for this one, you're going to need to be reminded that God goes with you. And you're going to need to listen and learn to trust him. And you're actually going to have to seek his voice. The Bible is far less interested in telling us what to think and far more interested in telling us how to think. Here's my favorite example of that. Proverbs 26, verse 4. The wisdom writer says these words, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him." That's true, isn't it? Right? We've experienced that to be true. Somebody posts something on social media, and it's dumb. And you read it, and not only is it dumb, it's kind of cruel, and it's kind of hurtful. And yet, you recognize that if you were to post a response back to this particular message, that you now have sunk to their level, and you are now also in the mud and slinging mud. You're just on the other side of that mud. And so what you've discovered is that the best response in that with that particular fool, the best response, that's the Bible's word, is no response. Have you been there? Okay, I hate making people raise their hands, but for the sake of helping me out, raise your hand if you've been there. Yeah, okay, all of us. Yeah, you've seen that. You've maybe been on the attack end of that. The passage goes on, that's verse 4. Here's Proverbs 26, verse 5, the very next verse. "Answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes." That's true also, isn't it? You ever see posts on social media and it's so wrong and it's so destructive and you find yourself saying, somebody's got to say something. The people are going to get hurt if they read this. I owe it to this person to say to them, you don't understand what you're talking about. You need to take your post down. You need to clarify it. It's not okay what you've posted. Raise a hand if you've been there. Yeah. Yeah, some of us are shyer on that one, but yeah. Raise your hand if you feel it at least. Yeah. Now, those two verses say literally the opposite thing. One says, don't answer the fool. The other says, you have to answer the fool. So what do you do? That's the point. I think that's why the Proverbs put those two next to each other. Let's be honest. It just depends on the circumstance. You actually can't just go to the book of Proverbs and quote that proverb because the next proverb says something else. You, in this moment, actually will need God. You will need to wrestle with God. You will need wisdom. You will need to ask your other Christian brothers and sisters, what would you do in this situation? You're going to need to talk and pray and listen and discern. It's not just simple. We don't like that, right? We don't like that. We want to go to the professional and just have the professional tell us what to do, right? Lawyer, you tell me what to do in this really complicated spiritual dilemma. Accountant, why don't you just fix our really complicated problem here? Why don't you just, in this case, it's the prophet, right? Naaman is a spiritual professional. Our Naaman's in a spiritual dilemma, and Elisha is a spiritual professional, and Naaman goes to the spiritual professional, and the spiritual professional says, go in peace. You're going to need to learn how to trust God in this one. You can't just outsource your listening and wrestling with God to a professional. You're going to need to learn how to do this work yourself. And that's where I want to leave us in this flannel graph series we've been in. For 5 weeks, we've been looking at all of the big themes and all of the big stories. We've talked about prayer. We've talked about loving your enemies. We've talked about forgiveness, the big subjects. And my guess is, at a couple of places in this series, you've said, yeah, but it's just not that clear. It's my situation is not black and white. It's just a little more complex. And forgive, like if you only understood exactly what I'm dealing with here. Yeah, it's complex. The reason it feels complex is because likely it is very, very complex. And the invitation of our God is not to pretend that complex situations are one size fits all and simple. The invitation is to pursue the voice of God, to pursue wisdom, and to learn how to wrestle with other humans as we try to figure this out, but with the scriptures as we try to figure it out. But ultimately, God, how do we hear your voice? If you've ever found yourself in a spot where you're wondering, am I doing the right thing? I know I find myself there. Is this the right thing? And it's like you're stuck between two options, and both options feel wrong. Or both options have their merit. Both options may be right. That's where the wrestling happens. And we cannot outskirt our wrestling. We cannot hand it off. We've got to learn how to do this work. And the spiritual professional just says, go in peace. Yeah, you don't... You want dirt, take dirt, but you do not need to load up your donkeys with dirt, because the ground beneath you is holy ground, because the God of Israel is the God of the whole world, and he's not locked here. So go in peace. If this morning you're in a space, maybe you just need to hear those three words. Go in peace. Go in peace. Go in peace. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this book and these stories, because it helps us feel seen. If I'm honest, Lord, it helps us feel understood. It helps us see that we're not the very first humans to struggle with this kind of stuff. Lord, but ultimately we do need to hear your voice. Lord, we do not want to make decisions based simply on what feels right in the moment. Lord, we want to make decisions that are the most loving and kind and compassionate, decisions that reflect you. Jesus, we want to look more like you in every situation we find ourselves in. And so, Spirit of the living God, would you speak to us, help us to speak to each other and to wrestle together. And then, Lord, would you give us grace where we mess it up, where we think we heard you and we just missed it. Lord, would you give us grace on the back end? Lord, would we find, no matter where we go, the peace of our God goes with us? We love you, Jesus. We pray this in your name. And everybody said, amen. Would you stand?
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so, from all of us here at South Harbor Church, we want to wish you a blessed week.